Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Don Edwards Lecture, hosted by San Jose State University and the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, and our presenting sponsors, Applied Materials and the Pacific Gas and Electric Company. I'm James Brent, Chair of the Department of Political Science at San Jose State University. It's my pleasure this evening to introduce Steve Poizner, California Insurance Commissioner and a candidate for Governor of California in 2010. Commissioner Poizner will speak for about 15 minutes, and then he'll be in conversation with San Jose State University Professor Larry Gersten with questions from the audience. And now, won't you please join me in welcoming Steve Poizner.
Well, thank you very much, and appreciate the invitation to be here. As insurance commissioner and a candidate for governor, I do get to go up and down the state giving lots of speeches, and sometimes the reception isn't as pleasant. Sometimes the introductions don't go quite as well. I was at a high school recently, not too far from here. The high school student stands up to introduce me. She had this incredibly bored look on her face. Her introduction to me was short and sweet. She said, this is Mr. Poizner. He's been an engineering geek in Silicon Valley for 20 years. Now he's into insurance. And she sat down. That was the whole introduction. Now, when I got home that evening, I couldn't help but to go talk to my 17-year-old daughter, Rebecca, and I had to ask her, why did you introduce me that way? Sad but true. Sad but true. Well, I am the California Insurance Commissioner, and some people wonder, well, why on earth did you run for that job? And I haven't been in politics very long, and as I introduced myself here before the Q&A from the professor, I do want to just tell you how I got involved in politics. My first foray in politics had to do with a huge civil rights battle, of all things. And I really didn't expect it to turn out that way. I graduated from Stanford Business School in 1980. Then I was living in Palo Alto, so I joined a community service organization in Palo Alto called the Palo Alto JCs, Junior Chamber of Commerce. It's a community service group, thousands of chapters around the country. Now, anyone can join the Palo Alto JCs, the JCs back then, if you were between the ages of 18 and 40, and if you were a man, men only. Now, in Palo Alto, we said, hey, this is nonsense. We decided to admit women anyways. It's a community service group. Why on earth? So we ended up becoming one of the largest JC chapters in the country. Hundreds of members, half men, half women. Everything was going pretty well. I became president of the local chapter in 1982. Now, the U.S. JCs, the parent organization, based in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And they were watching very carefully what every JC chapter does, and they were watching what we were doing here in Palo Alto. And they sent me a letter one day, a few months after I became president of the Palo Alto JCs, and I thought it was going to be a thank you letter for all the members we were recruiting, all the community service we were doing. Instead, it was a lawsuit. They were suing us for violating the men's only rule, and they were trying to throw us out of the USJCs. And we decided to fight back. And we fought back aggressively over this very important issue of women's rights. And believe it or not, to make a long story short, we took this case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 1984, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 7-0 that the USJCs had no business discriminating against women. It would have been 9-0, but two Supreme Court justices were past JCs, had to recuse themselves, and that became the precedent-setting case for the Kiwanis Club, the Lions Club, the Rotary Club. They all had to change their membership policies because of that one decision. Well, what do you think? That was pretty good, yeah. And what that showed me is that a small group of people, if you're passionate and focused, and you really focus on making change, small groups of people can make massive change in this country. And it convinced me that the political process and the legal process sometimes can be effectively utilized, you know, to improve people's lives, you know, here in California and across the country. Now, that was my first experience in politics back in the 80s. And then I spent most of the rest of my career after that in Silicon Valley running high-tech companies. And then a few years ago, decided to get involved in getting California back on track. In fact, I decided I just can't sit on the sidelines. The people running the state of California, yes, from both parties, driving this state off of a cliff. This state is in one of the worst crises it's been in since its inception in 1850. Now, People ask me quite often, well, why did you run for insurance commissioner? I mean, is that the most boring position you could have found? Actually, it's a fantastic job. Let me just tell you a little bit about it so you understand what I do every day. Insurance commissioner is one of only 8 positions elected statewide. From governor on down, insurance commissioner is one of the 8. And I oversee at the Department of Insurance a $200 million budget and over 1,000 employees, and we oversee everything insurance in the state of California. And that's a huge number. There's about $160 billion insurance industry in California. And when I make a decision, it impacts everybody, every business, every consumer, every family in the state of California. For example, health insurance companies in the state of California were canceling people's insurance illegally. People would apply for health insurance, then they would pay premiums year after year after year, and then people started using their health insurance, and the health insurance company would find some technical mistake that you made on the application canceling insurance. Part of what we've done over the last few years is we've been able to reinstate over 4,000 health insurance policies for people who've lost their insurance illegally, been able to get tens of millions of dollars of reimbursement to doctors and patients who shouldn't have lost their insurance in the first place. But I've also spent a lot of time looking internally in the Department of Insurance. Now, I know that's not the most glamorous part of my job, but fact is, a lot of great people at the Department of Insurance, but it's a pretty sleepy place when I got there. 1,300 people when I first got there, and we did a top-down review of every program, every dollar, and lo and behold, we found lots of programs that simply didn't matter anymore, that was just going on continually year after year. We actually got rid of a lot of programs that don't make a difference. We beefed up other programs that really do have an impact, like my insurance fraud unit. I have 300 police officers that work for me. We've arrested more people for insurance fraud in the last 2 years than any other 2-year period ever. That's an important area because insurance fraud gets passed on to you all in the form of higher insurance rates. But here's been the impact on my budget. You know about the budgets in Sacramento. They can't balance budgets there. That we're out of cash. State's bankrupt. Well, I started with 1,300 people. I now have about 1,100 people. I've been able to permanently reduce my expenses by 15%. I now have a huge surplus at the Department of Insurance, and I've taken my surplus and I've cut the taxes and fees on insurance agents and brokers that fund my department, and I've pushed millions of dollars back into the marketplace. Now, here's the broader point. Nothing unusual about the Department of Insurance when it's as state agencies go. There's 399 state agencies in the state of California. Well, correct that. There's now 400. Over the weekend, the legislature and the governor created a blueberry commission. Really? Seriously? So now we have 400 state agencies, now one focused on the sales of blueberries in the state of California. Yeah, you should ask yourself, in the middle of this crisis, how do they have time to do that? In any case, what needs to be done is we need to do a top-down review and an overhaul of every single state department and agency. And I'm promising you, there's billions of dollars to be saved by overhauling and modernizing the state of California. That's one of the key reasons why I'm running for governor. Now, it's urgent, really urgent, that the state of California as a government entity get its act together, because we are facing a huge economic crisis. 12.2% unemployment rate is the official unemployment rate in California. Now, the unofficial unemployment rate is closer to 15 or 16%. Lots of people just don't even look for jobs anymore. But let's just go with the 12.2%. That the official unemployment rate is the highest unemployment rate in the history of the state of California in the modern era. I mean, the last time we had unemployment that high, you know, it was back in the Great Depression era. Now, we've lost over 750,000 jobs the state of California has just in the last 12 months. And our unemployment rate in California, 2.5 points higher than the national average. Now, as an economy, we've been shrinking in terms of market share, so it's no surprise that our unemployment rate is through the roof. Look at the data. 1999, California had the 6th largest economy in the world. By 2003, we had fallen to 7th. Now we're the 8th largest economy and shrinking. We are rapidly losing market share in the global economy, and that's just a fact. Now, as we've been deteriorating as an economic powerhouse, our competitors are getting stronger and stronger and stronger. Take the not-so-friendly neighboring state of Nevada. Anybody here from Nevada? Good. Let's talk about Nevada for just a second. Nevada has appointed a SWAT team. That SWAT team reports directly to the governor. That SWAT team has just one mission: recruit people like you all to pick up and move from California to Nevada. And they're being very successful at it. Have you seen the TV ads and the full-page newspaper ads? The message from the state of Nevada is pretty simple. It says, if you do business in California, you're nuts. Come to the state of Nevada where there's no corporate income tax, zero. Where there's no personal income tax, zero. Where the workers' compensation insurance rates are 30% less than here in California, and the electricity stays on. And lo and behold, people are moving. Census Bureau, fact, 3,000 people a week, 3,000 taxpayers a week pick up and leave the state of California each and every week now. No wonder we can't balance the budget. The tax base is leaving the state. And they're not leaving just for nearby states. Of course, we compete with the whole world now, thanks to the global economy, thanks to technology coming out of Silicon Valley, ironically. Who are our three largest international competitors now? Well, India, China, Russia. Let's just look at those three, for example. If you just look at those three countries did not matter to us at all, much. Economically speaking, as little as 15 years ago. Well, that's changed drastically. If you add up all the people who live in those three countries, about 3 billion people. And if you assume that 90% of the people who live in those three countries are uneducated peasants, which is basically the case, you're still left with 300 million people, highly educated, aggressive, business people, scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs that for the first time in the history of our planet, these people can compete with us just fine by staying put and plugging in. So let me ask you all, what happens when you unleash 300 million new entrepreneurs into the global economy in a very short period of time? Well, you get rapid change. You get exponential change. Look what's going on at universities like San Jose State. Engineering. Look at freshman engineering students at this university. 50% of what they study their first year, obsolete by their third year now. Facebook. Facebook has over 200 million active users. If Facebook were a country, it would be the fifth largest in the world. There were more text messages sent yesterday than there are people on the planet. Probably a lot of those messages came from people here in this room. In China today, there are more people studying to learn English than speak English here in the United States. One final example of the changes that we're experiencing. Of all the people who got married in the United States last year, of all the people who got married, 1 in 8 met over the internet. Now, these changes are phenomenal. What an exciting time to be alive, to take advantage of these innovations and these technological improvements. But let me just tell you what my concern is. The people in Sacramento, yes, pretty much from both parties, are oblivious to these changes. Oblivious. We're in intense competition right now in this global economy, and if we don't make big, bold changes, we're going to get steamrolled. We're going to get steamrolled in the 21st century global economy. Now, what I want to do, let me just tell you why I'm running for governor, and I look forward to the Q&A. I'm running for governor because I want to make California the innovation capital of the world again. And when I'm talking about innovation, I'm not talking about just Silicon Valley, high tech. Of course, we're an amazing chapter, Silicon Valley. I'm talking about the fact that California has been a magnet for innovators for 150 years in all bunch of different categories. First, it was the ranchers who showed up in the early 1800s, very innovative. Then it was the farmers, then the miners, then it was aerospace, then it was communications and the arts and photography and the entertainment industry, then it was defense contractors, then it was hardware, then software, then wireless, then the internet, then nanotech, then biotech. One wave of innovators after another for 150 years. I've got to tell you, I am so proud to be a Californian because I don't know if you know this, but as a collection of people, we Californians have solved more of the world's problems. We have created more wealth than any other collection of people ever in the history of mankind, except maybe during the Renaissance period. This is a phenomenal state. Really, it's amazing. The culture, the natural resources, the beauty. People want to be here. Now, we just need to get out of people's way so they can, so people will come back to start and run companies like they used to. That's why the centerpiece of my jobs package are tax cuts. Now, I know that's controversial. The professor is going to drill me on this, I'm sure. The fact is, no one's talking about tax cuts right now. Everyone's talking about which taxes to raise in order to balance the budget. Well, let me just point out to you all that we've been trying to balance the budget for the last 10 years by raising taxes. And the result has been we've missed one revenue estimate after another, and the budget deficits have gotten worse and worse and worse. Fact is, we have one of the highest sales taxes, income taxes, vehicle license fees, and gas taxes in the country. So, mark my words, lower the tax rates, make us competitive again, total tax revenues will go up. I'm actually advocating a 10% across the board cut in personal income taxes, a 10% cut in corporate taxes, a 10% cut in sales taxes, and a 50% cut in capital gains taxes. And I've gotten a lot of questions already, you know, from folks. How on earth can we afford that when we can't even balance the budget right now? And of course, the answer is, how can we afford not to? President Kennedy figured this out. In the early 1960s, he cut personal income tax rates at the federal level substantially. Immediately, federal tax revenues increased. He cut the tax rates. Total tax revenues increased. President Reagan, of course, did the same thing in the 1980s. Significant tax cuts. Total federal tax revenues went up. At the state level, there's been five states that have had a bold across-the-board tax cuts in the last 20 years. Every time that's happened, total state tax revenues went up. That's the key. We need to understand that we're in competition now. We need to make California attractive again for Silicon Valley venture capitalists and entrepreneurs and business folks. Now, what does this have to do with balancing the budget? Well, everything. Everything. It makes all the difference in the world where companies decide to set up shop and to grow. Let me just give you one example and we'll wrap up here. My last company, SnapTrack. You know, I just spent 20 years in Silicon Valley starting and running companies. It's a very exciting place to be. And by the way, San Jose State, you all know you are the largest supplier of talent to Silicon Valley. Should be very proud of that. My last company, SnapTrack, that was the company where we figured out how to put a global positioning satellite receiver into a cell phone, so that when you dial 911 from the cell phone, the emergency operators will know where you're calling from. You all have my feature in every phone. Every phone's got it now. Over 700 million phones have this feature. Really proud of it because we've saved hundreds and hundreds of lives, people in a crisis situation dialing 911, and now we can pinpoint people down to a foot or two. So I did some math. What if I wouldn't have started this company here, but I started my company instead in my home state of Texas? What would have been the impact on California? So I ended up selling my company a few years ago to Qualcomm. So I did some math. I had 100 employees. How much in taxes did my 100 employees pay before we sold the company to Qualcomm? Sales taxes, income taxes, vehicle license fees, property taxes, beer taxes, wine taxes, hotel taxes. There's over 900 different taxes and fees in the state of California. And the answer? $100 million in taxes from one company. So if we would have started my company, SnapTrack, in my home state of Texas, rather than here in California, state and local governments would have been $100 million more in the hole. Google headquartered nearby. Google just celebrated its 10th anniversary. Google has 19,000 employees. Phenomenal success. Do the math on Google. If Google would have started its company in Nevada rather than here in California, our budget deficit would be $10 billion larger. It makes all the difference in the world where companies decide to set up shop, where they decide to expand and grow. That's what California is famous for. We need to overhaul our tax and our regulatory system in order to make that happen again, and we can do it. And that's exactly why I'm running for the governor of the state of California. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to be here. I really appreciate it. And if you give me a round of applause, I will answer any questions you have on any subject. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Commissioner Poizner, you're a tough act to follow. Let's begin with the taxes.
I knew it.
You got it. So you want to cut 10% from corporations, sales, incomes, and capital gains by 50%. And the theory is, if I have you right, that by cutting taxes will increase revenue.
Yes.
Okay. So we went through this in 1981 when Arthur Laffer, of course, suggested, let's cut taxes and we'll increase revenues. And by the time the Reagan administration was done in 1988, after a 25% tax cut, we went from $1 trillion national debt to $4 trillion national debt. If it didn't work then, help us understand why it would work now.
Right. A really good question, because the debt and the deficit did explode during that period of time. But the key point I want to underscore now is that total federal tax revenues went up, not down. The reason why we had such large deficits in debt in the 80s is because spending exploded. So I didn't talk about this much, but I can. But another key part of my platform for governor is to get our spending under control. So I don't see how we can balance the budget, though, with just getting spending under control. I mean, already universities and K through 12 high schools and roads and water systems, we're under a lot of pressure. We're not making necessary investments. So I really do think that the only way to get the money that we need to invest is to, first of all, do the top-down review so that we spend the money in the most optimized way, but at the same time, we need to revitalize the economy. And just like Reagan experienced and President Kennedy experienced and a lot of state governments have experienced, tax revenues can and will go up if you stimulate the economy. Now, it's not a direct linear relationship. You can't cut taxes to zero, because obviously that's silly. You need some tax rate, that's optimal. But in the case of California, I mean, we're at the extreme. If you take all of our taxes in California, all state and local taxes, and divide it by the number of people, you get a kind of a per capita tax burden, 50% higher than Nevada and Arizona. So we're off the deep end when it comes to taxes. Lower tax rates make California attractive again for taxpayers. These 3,000 people who are leaving each and every week, maybe they'll turn around.
Okay, let's talk about what's happened over the last year. It's been a tough year for the budget, as you acknowledged earlier. Between two efforts, the legislature and the governor lopped off $65 billion from the budget because we just weren't getting in the money that we needed. And as you said, perhaps if we lowered tax rates, we'd get in more. Question for you. Does that mean now that we still need to lop off more expenditures? And if so, in what area?
Right. I do think there's opportunities to overhaul and streamline. And I say this from personal experience. At the Department of Insurance, I went through this process of asking questions about every single program. And all too often, I'm serious, the answer was, when I asked the question, why are we doing this program here? I'm telling you, the answer was, because we've been doing it this way for 50 years. Does it help anybody? Well, no, it doesn't help anybody. Well, then stop it. Don't do it anymore. And so there's 400 different state agencies and state departments that haven't done a top-down review or a strategic plan ever. And so there are billions to be saved in each and every state agency. In addition, though, I just want to make sure that I know my campaign, the centerpiece of my campaign, is really different than what you'll hear from lots of different candidates. And I do want to make sure that everyone understands that my support for higher tax revenues is strong. I want tax revenues to go up so that we have the money to invest in higher education and in our infrastructure. It's just that we'll never be able to balance the budget. We'll never have the money to invest until we revitalize this very broken economy that we have.
You suggest that you're the candidate of reform. You said it several times. You talked about changing the things that go wrong in California. You talked about yourself as a reformer of health insurance, reforming state agencies that you just said. What area of reform do you think separates you from your two competitors, Meg Whitman and Tom Campbell?
Well, first of all, a lot of people are just totally stunned that the Republican Party would be having a very competitive primary with three people running, all from Silicon Valley. Now, there's a lot of political... How many political science majors are here? Well, you all know the Republican Party, not headquartered up here. It's down in Orange County, down in L.A. And so this is kind of an amazing thing that there's three of us running from this area. A lot of people kind of put us all in the same bucket. You must be similar. You're all from Silicon Valley. We're actually really quite different. And that's the great thing about political campaigns. It's about choices and differences and distinctions. And, you know, voters will have a choice here to make. In my case, you know, my background and my positions on issues really vary considerably. You know, one of my opponents actually does want to raise taxes to help balance the budget. Now, that would be Tom Campbell, and he's very thoughtful. He's got his reasons, but that's what he wants to do. Meg Whitman did say on national TV recently that there's nothing wrong with our tax structure. I just couldn't disagree with both of them more for all the reasons that I've said. We'll never get this economy back on track until we have a tax system that's competitive. The other thing that I think distinguishes me from some of my competitors is the fact that I have this particular passion for K through 12. And, you know, I'm still in the learning curve mode in terms of learning what goes on in the K through 12 public education system. But I did take a year of my life out to spend time in a high school nearby, Mount Pleasant High School. There's some Mount Pleasant people here. It's this great high school of, you know, 15 minutes from here. And it's being there in the trenches for a year was an eye-opener. Of course, you know, no one running for governor has done that. And I do think that we'll never get California back on track until we have a well-functioning public school system. But let me tell you about what I learned, though, at Mount Pleasant High School. And I understand from one of the teachers that I got a lot of help with, that they still have the same problem with leaky roofs. When I was at Mount Pleasant High School a few years ago, the roofs always leaked every time it rained. Today, Todd Richards, one of the great teachers at Mount Pleasant High School, had his roof completely, you know, was leaking, and his classroom was flooding. Now, hang on a second. This is a Silicon Valley public high school, wealthy Silicon Valley, leaky roof. Why can't they fix the roof at Mount Pleasant High School? Who runs the place, really? Well, as it turns out, it's not the teachers, and it's not the principal or the educators. Who runs the public schools now? I learned this firsthand. The legislature has taken over the public schools. They really have. And I'd love to talk more about public education reform, but it is a core part of my platform as compared to my competitors. Now, the legislature, just to finish the thought, they micromanaged the 5,000 schools in California through the state education code. Now, the state education code are these mandates. They apply uniformly to all 5,000 schools. That's kind of nonsense on the face of it. But the education code in the 1960s was about this size. Now the education code is 2,000 pages long and growing rapidly. And that's just got to change. We have to rip control of the public schools out of the hands of Sacramento politicians, and we need to move it down to the local level where it belongs and where it used to be. So people like Paul Osterkamp and Todd Richards and a lot of those other great teachers from Mount Pleasant High School and other high school teachers, so they actually can have control over the budget and the curriculum and the classroom. And a round of applause for teachers, if you wouldn't mind. They're just... Let me just say one last thing. Hardest thing I've ever done was to be in the classroom. Teachers are massively underappreciated in the high schools here in California. It's extremely difficult, and we need to give them more support, and we need to get more money into the classroom. Major difference between me and my candidate and my opponents there, by the way.
We're speaking with State Commissioner Steve Poizner, a candidate for the Republican candidate for governor. Let's talk about returning control to school districts and local governments. How do you feel about changing the vote requirements from two-thirds down to a majority vote to allow local governments and citizens there to take more direct control of the schools?
I don't support changing any of the vote requirements to increase taxes. I don't, because it'll just make it easier to raise taxes. You have to ask yourself, if you make it easier to raise taxes, do you think taxes are going to go up or down? Of course they're going to go up. Now, even with the two-thirds vote requirement for taxes, that hasn't stopped politicians from raising taxes to one of the highest levels, you know, in the country. So I really do think that it's important to get the money and the control of schools out of Sacramento down to the local level. But I wouldn't do anything to make our tax structure, you know, even worse. And lowering the thresholds would do that.
But is that a contradiction with returning control of the schools to local governments and local voters? Is that a contradiction in the sense that you're making a higher or maintaining a higher voting requirement than a majority rule?
Well, no. I mean, I want the control to be here at the local level and not in Sacramento. That's the key local control concept that I'm advocating. Keeping the threshold at two-thirds. You know, was it Madison or Jefferson? Maybe somebody can tell me which one it was. But one of them said, you know, the power of government to tax can cause a lot of damage. That was the essence of his quote. And that's a fact. When you tax people, you're taking wealth and property. I mean, it should only happen when a supermajority of people agree. And that's why I support those two-third vote thresholds.
We've got a lot of questions on taxes here, so bear with me for a moment.
My favorite subject.
And I am the messenger,
right.
That's all.
Okay.
A number of people have questioned that perhaps we don't have enough different sources of taxes, not necessarily raising any particular level, but we don't have enough sources, one of which happens to include the oil severance tax, which, as you know probably, 13 of the 14 states that produce oil have some level of oil severance tax. California is the only state that does not. Assemblyman Tirico nearby has authored Assembly Bill 656, which would impose about a 9% severance tax on oil coming out of the ground, which would yield about $1 billion for various levels of public education. Given that this area has not been taxed at all in California, we're the only state that's not done that, given the shortfalls in K-12 and higher education, how do you feel about this proposal?
Well, you have to look at the total tax burden. Fact is, all companies in California, including the oil companies, pay a lot in one of the highest corporate income tax rates, property taxes, sales taxes, excise taxes. So the total tax burden on companies, including oil companies, is one of the highest in the country already. So I don't think it makes sense to make it less attractive for any company, including oil companies, to be doing business here in California. I just don't support anything that starts with the word raising taxes is just a bad idea right now. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with Silicon Valley executives, just to give you an example. Cisco. We haven't created a new tech job in California in a decade. Hewlett-Packard. We wouldn't create a new manufacturing facility in California. It's no man's land. Intel just announced a major chip expansion with President Obama, building all these new chip manufacturing facilities all over the country. There are none in California, no new ones. They're laying people off in California. Google has these massive server farms that process all these Google searches, right? Those server farms are everywhere but California. So we have to stop thinking about how we can raise taxes on anybody. We want more companies to come here, start and grow. That will give us a growing, healthy economy. That's how we're going to generate the revenues we need for higher education and for K-12. And I do support investing more, a lot more in K-12 and in higher education. But we have to get there, you know, through building a healthy, growing economy.
One more question about taxes.
Excuse me. I know you say you want more engineers and you want more business.
Excuse me. This is something
but
where please sit
no
down.
Plan
please sit down. Please sit down.
Gigantic cuts to higher education in this
please
state.
Sit down. Thank
do you expect
you
education
please
to follow?
Sit down.
We're going on the
thank
coattails
you
of the economy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Kick us out. We'll vote you down.
We want to keep this a very nice conversation, one in which we respect all the different opinions of everyone here, and that's why we welcome your questions, and we'll continue to ask as many as we can.
Let me just say one thing.
Continue with our
discussion.
You
know you're a serious candidate for governor when you get protesters. So.
There you go. All right. Congratulations. You're the first one to get this,
yeah,
by the
I
way. You've got sort of a medal of distinction here.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. We'll look forward to 11 o'clock tonight.
Yes.
One more question about taxes. I know you've made yourself clear, but we're going to ask this anyway. California now ranks 32nd in tobacco taxes. Tobacco taxes have been used to help with health care, particularly for children, First Five, and other programs that help kids get inoculated, help them get health insurance. And as we know, California lags behind most states in children's health insurance. What do you feel about raising the tobacco tax, something that was defeated a couple of years ago and that others are suggesting again, as a means, as a user tax, to try to help kids get more health insurance and better health care?
Right. Well, I have two concerns about tobacco taxes, increasing them. One is that it's very regressive. The fact is the people who would be paying this tax would be mainly middle and lower income folks who are already struggling to make ends meet right now. And so to put a greater burden on them in the middle of this deep recession, you know, is just a bad mistake. And the other thing about tobacco taxes is that as you raise them, you drive down usage. And so if you build spending programs that depend on that revenue source when the usage levels are dropping, then you end up creating, you know, structural budget deficits later on. Not a good idea.
Some would suggest, just to follow up, that even if you start collecting fewer taxes from tobacco, that the result would more than offset those taxes because kids would be healthier. Do you see that as a net plus, or it wouldn't matter?
Well, for the reasons that I've said, I just can't imagine that's the only solution. We need to get more money into higher education in K-12 and in children's health programs. But I think you understand my core principle here. The centerpiece of my campaign, voters will either agree or disagree with me, the way we get more money is to make California attractive again for job growth.
So
and that's the key. And raising taxes on people who do buy a lot of cigarettes right now, it's a fact. It's going to put a burden on working class families when they're barely hanging on to their mortgages as it is. It would be very regressive, and I just oppose it.
Okay. So it comes down to this. We've seen expenditures for K-12 decline rapidly over the last few years. California now ranks, depending upon the study, anywhere between 30 and 48th in per capita expenditures, depending upon how you view the money being spent. We've seen higher education fees double in the last 5 years, with the promise of even greater increases in the next few years. We're going to reduce taxes with the hope that more money comes in because California becomes an attractive state.
I mean, it's happened every time. Every time that a state has reduced taxes, tax revenues have gone up. So it's more than a hope. We've actually done a very detailed economic analysis of it.
So your belief then would be, based on the other five states and based on
federal experiences,
the
too.
Largest of yeah. the eighth largest, yeah. basically the eighth largest economy in the world, that by lowering taxes, we would be able to increase spending for K-12 and increase spending for higher ed.
Absolutely, that's the plan. And let me just say one other thing about K-12, and I learned this from a lot of the other teachers at Mount Pleasant High School too, that there's a lot of inefficiency in the current system. And we should also turn our attention to making sure that we're spending the $40 billion a year on K-12 that we spend approximately, that we're spending that in an efficient and effective way. Fact is, there are these 5,000 schools that report to 1,000 school districts. Some school districts have one school. Now, some school districts have dozens of schools, but no matter whether you have dozens of schools or one school, you have a school board and a superintendent and a staff. Now, these 1,000 school districts report to 58 county boards of education. Now, there's 58 counties. Each county board, no matter whether you're a big county or a small rural county, each county board of education has a superintendent and a staff and a board. These 58 county boards of education in our K-12 system report to, well, it's not clear. Who do they report to? There's the elected superintendent of public instruction. There's the appointed secretary of education. There's the state board of education. And then there's the Department of Education. Now, this very fragmented system, you take it, and then you overlay the 2,000 pages of the state education code coming out of the legislature, and you have one dysfunctional system. They have over 600,000 people who work for K-12 in California, over 600,000. And over 50% of the people who work for K-12 are not in the classroom. Now think about that. Think about all the money that we currently spend that never makes it even close to the classroom. I want to push control down the local level. Let's get more money immediately into the classroom just by spending less on this, on all these layers and all this bureaucracy. And then as tax revenues go up over time, education is going to be one of my highest priorities. As you all know, you can confirm this. Every dollar we spend in higher education, we get a 4X return. I mean, it's a great investment to invest in higher education in the state of California. I can just tell you, it's going to be one of my highest priorities as governor.
Let's continue with K-12, which, as we know, gets about 40% of the general fund. So it is the most expensive part of our state budget. We have 1,000 school districts in the state. We have 1,000 superintendents. We have several thousand deputy superintendents. And it goes on and on all the way down when you talk about the bureaucracy. How do you feel about collapsing some of these smaller districts to make them more efficient and put more money into the classroom?
I absolutely support that. Absolutely support that. I mean, you can't have – we have hundreds of school districts with just one school. So out of 1,000, there's hundreds that just have one school. We can't afford to have that anymore. And so in county boards of education, we don't need 58 of them either. All kinds of opportunities to consolidate and streamline, get more money into the classroom. And can I say just one thing about charter schools, just to put that on the table? Now, charter schools, you know, controversial in some camps, some quarters, but charter schools are a very, very interesting experiment that all of you should closely look at when you're evaluating public education reform. Now, charter schools are public schools in California, but the state education code, that's 2,000 pages of education code, are waived mainly for charter schools. So charter schools are an experiment in local control. And there's 800 charter schools now in California. 4% of all California public school kids go to charter schools. Now, some charter schools haven't worked out, and they've closed down. But some charter schools are outstanding because teachers and principals are freed up, you know, to have control over the budgets, over the curriculum. And some of the charter schools are performing in a fantastic way. What I want to do as governor is provide all schools with the same type of freedom and flexibility that charter schools have.
One more question about K-12 because it's so important to the state and, of course, to the university. In Los Angeles County, the school district there has 200 teachers, more than 200 teachers, who are no longer in the classroom but on the employment roster, getting full pay, not teaching because they've been accused of various issues that reflect on their teaching. It could be all kinds of things from harassment to incompetence and whatnot. They have not been removed. They get paid every day, and they continue that for until they retire. Do you believe that unions, when it comes to public education, have become too powerful? And what would you do, if so, in order to correct this, in order to make schools more efficient?
Yeah, I thought unions were the centerpiece of the problem of the public education system until I started working at Mount Pleasant High School. And all those other teachers there, I was a volunteer, but the other teachers, you know, were all members of the California Teachers Association. And I developed an appreciation for why they turned to the union. I mean, these teachers, you know, they're under assault. They read in the paper every day about how lousy the schools are. There's, you know, money is being ripped out of the public school system, and the union is their only place they can turn to for some support and some strength. And so I now understand a little bit more about why the teachers are so supportive of the union. But with that said, the teachers union clearly has taken certain positions when it comes to low-performing or bad-performing teachers that's just outright wrong. And the L.A. Times did a great expose that you're talking about where they have, you know, teachers in the L.A. Unified School District that aren't in the classroom anymore because they were dangerous or lousy teachers. They ripped them out of the classroom, at least. And now they're at home getting full salary because you can't fire them. I mean, that's just wrong. I mean, we're broke now. Remember, every dollar that gets spent inefficiently or gets spent on a teacher that's not performing, that's a dollar that's coming right out of your classroom, coming right out of this university. And low-performing teachers need to be terminated, and that's got to change. And the union is going to have to step up to that, or the voters are going to make some radical change because voters are going to get really frustrated with, you know, teachers that are getting paid that aren't even working.
70% of the general fund in the California budget is mandated in advance for public education, mental health, a variety of services and programs, leaving only 30% to be really at the discretion of the legislature. What do you feel about these programs that have been mandated, in many cases, by the voters? Would you do anything to change that, or do you think they ought to continue?
Well, I do think it is a bit of a myth when people say that the legislature can't get the job done because that all these ballot initiatives have tied their hands. Fact is, most of the revenues flowing into the state of California, even if they've been earmarked by some ballot initiative, the legislature with a two-thirds vote which is the vote percentage that required anyways to pass a budget. They can suspend most of these initiatives. Now, not all of them. I mean, there's certain that are just certain initiatives have locked up the money. But the vast majority of the money is in the control of the governor and the legislature. And I don't know about you, but I'm really kind of sick and tired of the governor and the legislature blaming everybody else. You know, we can't fix these problems, the problems of the Constitution, the problems of these ballot initiatives, the problems of the voters. No. No, the legislature and the governor, they have the power and the control to balance the budget, to stimulate our economy, to bring jobs back to California. They can do all these things. What's lacking is the right kind of leadership. The right kind of backbone to deal with these issues. Now, voter and ballot initiatives, you know, the reason why these ballot initiatives have become so popular is because the legislature is not doing anything for decades, and people get frustrated and put these ballot initiatives in front of folks. Do you know, though, that 80% of all ballot initiatives fail now? I mean, when you get this ballot pamphlet, it's all thick, you know, in the mail. People are like, no, just no. People just vote no on most of these things now. So it's hard to get these ballot initiatives passed. But thank goodness that safety valve is there, personally. The voters have had to take power into their own hands occasionally, unfortunately. And that's why I support some major changes in terms of how the legislature is structured because we need a much better functioning legislature. And be happy to talk about some of those changes I support.
Let's talk about it.
Part-time legislature.
A part-time legislature given a $100 billion plus budget.
A lot of states like Texas and Florida and others have a part-time legislature. California had a part-time legislature from 1850 to 1967. Then a ballot initiative changed it to become a full-time legislature. And ladies and gentlemen, let me just say that I think you can look at that date as one of the starting points for the deterioration of the decision-making process in Sacramento, because a professional class of politicians emerged after the legislature became full-time in the late 1960s that have been very harmful to the state of California. Now, these are politicians on both sides of the aisle that get their sole paycheck from you all, from taxpayers. That's not a healthy thing. We want people that come out of the trenches. We want teachers and educators and taxi cab drivers and truck drivers and business people and police officers, people that get a paycheck someplace, that have distinguished themselves locally, that come from the trenches. Send them to Sacramento and have them work on these tough policy issues. The other benefit of a part-time legislature would be it would force the legislature just to focus on just those few items that actually make a difference. Now, the governor and the legislature, you know, we've been following what happened recently. 700 bills they just passed in the last couple of months. And a lot of those bills are nonsense bills. I mean, I mentioned the Blueberry Commission. Really? They actually debated whether to have a commission, a state commission, to focus on the sales of blueberries. And the governor actually signed it into law. This is just silliness. We should stop it. Now, a part-time legislature, I think, would transform the whole body into a mix of people that actually have wisdom and experience from the local level.
One more question about the legislature. Let's go to a part-time legislature for a second. Some people suggest that if we had a part-time legislature, that only the wealthy and the retired would be able to stop what they're doing for 3 or 4 months every year, every other year, and do that, leaving out everybody else in the middle class and below. What do you say to that?
Well, unfortunately, the whole election process in California, I mean, you have to be wealthy or you have to really sell yourself to special interest groups, one or the other, right now, today. Now, the part-time legislature is not perfect because it's just, there's no perfect system when you're dealing with human beings and all. But I do think that if you were working half-time in the legislature for about a three-month period or so and focusing on key legislation, then you wouldn't have to give up your career. And I think people, you know, in various parts of their career, later stage in their career, could afford, you know, to go to Sacramento, represent their local community. And I think that would be drastically better than what we have today, which are a bunch of these professional politicians that are either very wealthy or they raise these huge sums of money from these special interest groups. And I don't think that's a good thing for California at all.
Okay. We're speaking with State Insurance Commissioner Steve Poizner, Republican candidate for governor. Let's turn a little bit to the relationship between state and local governments. What's your opinion about the state taking money back from local governments to balance the budget? What should be done to give local governments more secure revenues?
I think that when the governor and the legislature in this last budget balancing fiasco, and it was a fiasco because it was a lot of smoke and mirrors, and they also dipped into monies here at the local level and took it, that should be illegal. And as governor, I will work to prohibit state governments from tapping in to these sources of county and local money. They shouldn't be pilfering local resources to balance the state budget. That just pushes the problem down to the local level. That doesn't solve any problem at all. It just creates problems for the local folks. I'm a big believer in local control in general. I talked about local control in schools. I believe in local control just in general. Not that local politicians are all perfect. You know, we'll have problems with school boards and mayors because, you know, humans, some of them are great and some of them are not so great. But at least when you're dealing with someone locally, you know, you see them, you know, at the Rotary Club and you see them at the grocery store and you see them at the ball game and on the soccer field. If you don't like what he or she's doing, you're going to tell them. And you know where they live and you can find them and you can make sure that they understand how angry you are. And then when the election comes up to reelect them, you can run somebody against that person. But when you're trying to deal with some amorphous force in Sacramento, it's like a black hole. We got to get the power out of Sacramento back down here, back down to the local leaders.
Okay. AB 32, California's landmark legislation designed to reduce the state's emissions, overcome the problems of global warming, and no doubt impose a good deal of regulations on businesses and others in order to meet this objective. As governor, would you fully support AB 32, or would you, in fact, change it and perhaps make it weaker, and why?
Well, this is a very difficult question. It's difficult because many people in the state of California, including probably a lot of people here in this room, and including me, we care about the environment. We want to clean up the environment. I have solar cells on my roof. I mean, I've been taking steps, you know, to clean up the environment, too, like I bet a lot of you all have. But the problem, and I'm just honestly just tell you how I feel about this, the problem is that when our environmental laws become so strict and extreme, when we're completely out of sync with what every other state's doing or what the federal government's doing, then we have an impact that actually hurts, not helps. And here's what I mean. California is not an environmental island. I mean, we're talking global warming. It's not state warming. It's global warming. We're not an economic island either. So AB 32 actually imposes huge new costs on manufacturing companies and lots of different businesses. Now, if every other state was doing that, that'd be one thing. But California is unique. So I can tell you what's going to happen. I can promise you what's going to happen. When AB 32 goes into effect soon, it will push whatever manufacturing in California that's left, which isn't much, it'll push them out of the state. Now, where do they go? They will go to the Midwest often. And in the Midwest, manufacturing plants are dependent more on coal-burning fire plants. And so here comes the irony. Our environmental laws have actually hurt the environment. I'm positive of it because we lose the jobs, we lose the manufacturing base, and it goes to the Midwest where they use more polluting, more dirty coal-burning fire plants, which actually hurts. So what I want to do is I support these environmental protections, but they need to be in sync with federal standards, what the federal government's doing and what other states are doing. So I want to work to modify these rules so that we're in sync with the rest of the country and we don't stick out like a sore thumb.
A follow-up. About 2 years ago, the state of California asked for a waiver to the 1970 Clean Air Act, which it had done 44 times successfully in the past, to enable the state to have even stricter conditions for auto emissions. The Bush administration and the EPA denied that, as you know, and only after a U.S. Supreme Court decision and some other regulatory hurdles did California get the waiver, which then the Obama administration has made as a national template. Comparing that with AB 32, if the Obama administration decided to make AB 32 as a national template, would you support that?
Well, I have a lot less concerns if we're in sync with federal standards.
Okay. Let's move along. Let's talk about gay marriage. Many different opinions about this. Proposition 8, of course, mm-hmm. which has riveted many people throughout the state and the nation, remains a test before the courts. Perhaps another a ballot proposition in 2010 or 12. What is your position about gay marriage, civil unions, domestic partnerships, and why?
Well, some of you are going to agree, some of you are going to disagree, but this is a very controversial issue. We all know about half the states one way, half the states another. I mean, there's no broad consensus on this one. I support traditional marriage. I mean, I believe in marriage that should be, I know, between a man and a woman. That's what I believe. But at the same time, I also don't want, the government discriminating against gay couples or straight couples when it comes to civil unions or domestic partnerships. So as governor, I'm going to fight to the death to make sure there's no discrimination going on in this state and that civil unions and domestic partnerships are given out in a non-discriminatory way. But when it comes to marriage, I mean, it defined thousands of years ago, and I'm just a believer in the traditional definition.
And although you believe, and just to clarify, although you believe in traditional marriage as an individual, you would support civil unions?
Oh, absolutely. I do. I absolutely support
domestic civil unions. Partnerships.
And I support both domestic partnerships and civil unions.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Just checking. Here's a question that is near and dear to several people in this room, I would suspect. What do you plan to do about the increased tuition and fee rates for college students at the CSU system and UC?
Right. I don't think it makes any sense to make it harder for people to go to California's higher education system. As I mentioned a moment ago, every dollar that California taxpayers invest in our higher education system, we get a 4x return. What a fantastic return for taxpayers. So I look at higher education as part of our infrastructure, part of the investments we need to make for the long haul. So I think that raising fees should be the very last resort, and hopefully no more fee increases will be necessary. But what I do think we need to do, though, is we need to start generating enough economic activity in this state so that we can afford to continue to make the heavy investments that the state of California has made into its crown jewel, which is our higher education system.
So let's circle back for a moment and try to weave together a couple of things, major points you've made. You've talked about reducing taxes at virtually all levels, 10%, capital gains, 50%, and you say that will create more income for the state. You've also mentioned that you want to increase funding for K through 12, which I believe you said is underfunded. You want to increase funding for higher ed. K through 12 and higher ed are about half the general fund. You put them together. What indications do you have that the reduced taxes that you're talking about will leave us with so much more, so many more tens of billions of dollars? I know you mentioned 5 states, but have you calculated any long-term projections that would lead us to actually raise more money to offset all those losses in taxes and, in fact, add to K through 12 and
yes.
IRA?
Well, first of all, let's just be clear. The state's bankrupt, out of cash, worst credit rating of all 50 states, can't even borrow money anymore economically. So let's just be straight. We're out of money, broke. So there isn't any more money to invest in K through 12. There's no more money to invest in higher education. The money is gone. Raise taxes, and it'll even get worse. We know that for a fact. We've been raising taxes for 10 years, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. That's a given. So how do we fix it? We fix it by recognizing the fact that people want to be here in California. It's a beautiful, marvelous place. Companies want to be here, and entrepreneurs, business people, investors want to be here. Let's just get out of their way so that they can come back to California, start all these companies. I know we've talked about this theme, several times in the course of this discussion, but that is the centerpiece theme of my campaign. And I'll be the next governor if a majority of people agree with me that the way to solve our budget mess is to overhaul our tax and our regulatory system so California can be the magnet for innovators and entrepreneurs. Again, and then tax revenues will go up. It's not going to happen all at once. We've gotten into this mess over a period of many decades, and so we're not going to immediately be able to turn the tax and the regulatory system around where we get tens of billions overnight. But we do have a bunch of economic modelers in our campaign where we've closely modeled out how quickly do revenues turn around in those other states when they've lowered taxes? What is the magnitude of the increase in tax revenues? And we actually have models now based on the exact experience in those other states. So we've put those models to work here with my tax plan, and we do believe that over the first several years of my tax proposals, there's billions of dollars of new tax revenues that are generated. That, in parallel with my right-sizing efforts to streamline state government, we will be able to balance the budget, in a pretty straightforward fashion. And then over the course of my first 4 years, I plan to have budget surpluses that we then can begin to invest in the water infrastructure, into higher education, into K-12. These are long-term investments that we need to make for the long haul. But that money, we don't have the money. The money's gone. So how can we generate that money over a several-year period by revitalizing our economy? Then we make the investments once the money comes in.
You mentioned water and the fact, of course, we know that the governor has called a special session of the legislature this week to deal with water issues. There's good talk about a $9 billion program, most of which would be funded by bonds. As you know, California ranks among the worst states in bonded indebtedness, gone through the roof. What do you think about the proposal to finance our water issues with even more bonds?
Well, we here in Silicon Valley, I'm not sure we fully feel the pain of the water crisis. I've spent a lot of time in the Central Valley. Now, the Central Valley is the breadbasket for the world when it comes to fruit and vegetables. And unfortunately, the water crisis has caused tens of thousands of farm workers to be laid off. A lot of farms have been decimated because there's not enough water. Now, the water is there. The water is in the delta, but the pumps have been turned off for various reasons. And I think it's personally, there's one federal judge that has taken over the water supply of the state of California, and I don't know if there's any lawyers here or constitutional law experts, but I think it's wrong when one federal judge takes over the water supply of a state. And I think it's a state's rights issue because by trying to protect, a particular fish in the delta, that judge has caused lots of damage to the environment. I already mentioned all the farm workers that have been laid off. But when you don't get water out of the delta because the pumps have been turned off, what happens is that farmers start using groundwater. And when you pump water out of the ground, you can measure how the valley floor in the Fresno area, how it's sinking. You're really doing lots of damage to the environment. So I really think it's just critical that we turn those pumps on. Now, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, never been a speaker from California until Nancy. She supported in 2004, in New Mexico when they were having a drought, she supported the more flexible adaptation of the Endangered Species Act for the people in New Mexico to help them through their water crisis. And she needs to do the same thing here, and that's how we can help deal with some of our short-term immediate issues that are really doing a lot of damage, like I say, to the environment, not just to the ag community. But longer term, we do need to build more water storage. We do. And so I do support – I don't like using debt to deal with budget deficits. That should be illegal. But using bonds to invest in the long-term infrastructure of the state of California is a wise and thoughtful investment, and I would support that.
Okay. We have time for one last question. As a graduating college senior, is there any way I can get involved with your campaign as an intern? How can I go about doing that?
Well, that's a great question. I need someone to help create signs. first of all, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you for the hospitality. If any of you would like to get involved in my campaign, I do send you to my website where you can get a lot more information about my campaign, and I'd love to have you volunteer. We're going to have a huge army of volunteers helping us. StevePoisner.com is my website. Would love to get your help and support. And thank you again for the invitation to be here.
Thank you.
I hope you have all enjoyed this evening's Don Edwards Lecture program brought to you by San Jose State University and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank California Insurance Commissioner and 2010 California gubernatorial candidate Steve Poizner. San Jose State professor and NBC 11 political analyst Larry Gersten. Our audience here at San Jose State University, and all of those of you joining us at home on the radio. And now, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.